Thank you, Irv, for inviting me to revisit Marcuse's work. It's really a pleasure for me. When I sat down to prepare for this, I realized I haven't really taught about or talked about Marcuse for so long. And even though I am professionally a teacher, I teach ancient civilizations in the MFA is the main course I teach, and currently East Asian social movements, which is the book I'm working on now, the East Asian uprising since the Gwangju uprising in 1980. Marcuse had an enormous influence on me, among other things, convincing me that I didn't need to make a choice between being a radical activist and an intellectual, and showing me, in fact, that the two went together very well, and that it made a lot of sense to me. At the time I met him, I was driving a taxi at night in San Diego and doing political work. And I remember distinctly one day at Red House, the commune where I lived, I was repairing a car for a friend for some extra cash. And I had grease all over me, and I looked at my illegal alien Mexican friend Lino, and I said, "Lino, this sucks." And he said to me, "Why don't you do what Herbert tells you and become an intellectual?" It just dawned on me, that's a good idea. I would much rather make a living doing that. So it was a choice also for me that was much more pleasurable. And, to use my mind to contribute somehow to human liberation through the act of critical thinking. And so it's an integration for me personally in my life that I wouldn't have been able to make without his guidance. And to reconnect with this particular work is also very interesting because I taught this book in my first teaching class. I got a job in 1983 at UC Irvine for one course, and I chose this book as the book to teach for the course. And I haven't taught it since. I've glanced at it and used it in some of the books I've written, but I haven't really discussed it with people. And I think actually it's Marcuse's most important book for social movements, for left-wing social movements. This is his second to the last book. His last book was The Aesthetic Dimension, about art. This book has a very long chapter on art, but he mentions in this book that he needs another book to really develop fully his understanding of the aesthetic dimension. And that becomes his last book. So this is his second to the last book. It's written, it's published in 1972. So it's written in 70 and 71, at a time when many people, like here in Cambridge, you know, the Kent State shootings had led to a massive uproar on campuses here and around the country. In fact, it was the largest single strike in the history of the United States. More than 4 million students and 500,000 faculty in a political strike against the war in Vietnam, against the university's complicity with war research, and against the repression of the Black Panther Party. There was no demand for tuition going down, no demand for better food or, you know, drinking on campus or whatever students might want, co-ed dorms, which didn't exist at the time. None of that was included. This was a political strike. Many of us who were in the universities at that time thought, my goodness, the revolution is around the corner. In fact, at the time, the New York Times reported that more than 1 million people on the campuses thought that a revolution was necessary in the United States. In this context, Marcuse is writing, actually, what's happened is a revolt, and that the dominant tendency today is a counter-revolution, a preventative counter-revolution. When the book came out, I hadn't heard of Marcuse until much later. But when the book came out, I was thinking in terms of revolution. And Marcuse is way ahead of us, I think, in saying, look, what's actually happening here is a preventative counter-revolution. I first met Marcuse right after the bombing of Hanoi. So that would be in late 72, early 73. Bruce Franklin, a unrepentant Stalinist, came to San Diego. And people in the movement didn't know who should escort him around town. And they chose me. because they knew I would not put up with his nonsense about Stalin, and that I could stand up to him. So, but I had never read Marcuse nor met him, and Franklin said to me he wanted to meet Marcuse. Would I call Marcuse? I said, well, sure, I'll call Marcuse. Why don't you call Marcuse? He said he'd never meet me if I called him, but if you call him, he might. And so I called Marcuse, and we chatted, and then we became acquainted with each other, and one thing led to another. I began inviting him to my house and my commune, Red House, and to study groups. And at a certain point, I modestly said to Herbert, I think we agree on a lot of things. So couldn't we find a way to work more together? And he said, well, why don't you enroll at the university? And I ended up enrolling at the university. I almost dropped out, as you can imagine, many times because of the conservative faculty who were there. And Marcuse just would laugh at my dilemmas, my, you know, whatever, and just say, well, if this is going to defeat you, then, you know, are you really serious about what you're doing? Or have another drink or whatever. So this book, as I say, is really underread. Perry Anderson wrote about Marcuse and admitted to me he had not read the book. The book was not kept in print very long, and yet I think not only did Marcuse understand that a counter-revolution was occurring, he also understood dimensions around which the movement in the future would be able to find an impact. That is, ecology and art. And these are the two major chapters besides the chapter on the left under the counter-revolution. I think today, you know, we even see Al Gore making a PowerPoint movie about ecology, but we've seen the green movements in Europe, in the United States. We've seen the Kenya Greenbelt movements. We've seen how ecology has become a major issue. What's really interesting to me about the chapter on nature in this book, however, is that Marcuse very explicitly ties this to internal nature, to psychology, to us as human beings, to the body and the soul as elements of that which needs to be revolutionized. Critical theory, if you know the tradition of German idealist philosophy, has an aversion to the irrational. It really seeks to find the rational kernel, the logic of unfolding rationality in history, for instance, is Hegel's quest in the philosophy of history. The logic of the rationality of mind and of spirit, for Hegel. The rationality of the three judgments for Kant. And Marcuse comes out of this tradition of being overly rational, and is able to move far beyond this. So even for his greatest contemporary in terms of the present day, Jürgen Habermas, Habermas regards the unconscious as inner foreign territory. Inner foreign territory for Habermas, which, you know, makes total sense because he is such a rationalist. Habermas's project, I think, is to establish some communicative competence, some, you know, finding a way to have discourse. And if we can have real discourse, then we can all agree that capitalism is irrational and come to a more just society, for instance. And Marcuse is saying, you know, frankly, rationality is insufficient. In fact, it's the very rationality of the whole system that makes it irrational. So this is in the book, the phrase that, you know, I love the phrase, the insane rationality of the whole. So Marcuse is able to see that taking rationality to its limits is an insanity. You and I speak about this today, I believe, under the rubric of globalization or corporate globalization, the extension of the market economy to all countries, to all aspects of life, the rationality of profitable production, that you can make something for less in China, shut the factory in South Carolina, make it in China, spend, you know, lots of money polluting the earth with oil to transport it here. But the rationality is very much there in the bottom line of the big corporations. So Marcuse is able to say this is insane. I think if we go back to the language of German idealist philosophy, the way to approach this is to say that there is a difference between rationality and reasonability. Reasonability. So that even though something, you know, 2 + 2 might equal 4, there's a level on which mathematical logic is not sufficient to understand the philosophical project of liberation. In fact, as we all know, 2 + 2 can be 7 if people have kids, or 2 + 2 can be 3 if people kill each other or something. So, you know, in terms of human relations, mathematical rationality, and rationality understood as a logical form that does not include the heart, the soul, the inner human understanding, is an insufficient form for us to try to discuss liberation and the project of liberation. This is a great insight. I think that it challenges even the best of our contemporary theorists, Noam Chomsky, and people who are able to make such trenchant critiques of American foreign policy, have not dealt with this level of philosophical critique that Marcuse swims in. This is the stuff of which Marcuse is. You know, this is what he's about, to me. Laughing at my dilemmas, or laughing at the insane rationality of the whole. This is a wonderful transcendental moment that Marcuse continually exhibits. So I think we can say that one of the main arguments in this book is that as humans in the modern society and contemporary society, you know, we say postmodernism or whatever, but as humans today are made into the subjects of their own oppression, we become the subjects of our own oppression. Marcuse has a variety of concepts to help us delve into this. Psychic thermidor. The idea that revolutions defeat themselves. It's not necessarily the forces of thermidor, of reaction, that kill us all and line us up, you know, the 30,000 after the Paris Commune were lined up and shot. No, we defeat ourselves. We go home, we... Psychic thermidor, or surplus repression, or the repressive desublimation. These are concepts, these are handles for us to be able to say we're the subjects of our own repression today, increasingly. That for Marcuse, then, the body and the psyche become objects for revolutionary change. So, you know, this is nothing new. We all say, well, you know, we knew this. We have to change ourselves to have a free society. But remember, Marcuse is writing this in 1970. He's writing this at a moment when I think the movement is moving along saying, oh, we're headed toward a revolution, right? We're getting Huey Newton out of jail. The Black Panther Party is convening the Revolutionary People's Constitutional Convention. 10,000 people gather in Philadelphia to write a new constitution. The women's liberation movement is, you know, growing by leaps and bounds. The revolutionary movements in the third world are appearing in places no one ever heard of, Guinea-Bissau, or Angola, Mozambique. You have a real veritable sense, a palpable feeling of revolution in the air. The Jefferson Airplane is producing albums that secretly glorify the Weather Underground. Diana Otten's death is memorialized in rock and roll, and Bob Dylan is writing lyrics about George Jackson being murdered in San Quentin. And, you know, Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young did the song about Ohio and Kent State. And so you have this feeling, you know, I did, and millions of us did, I think. Revolution's moving ahead. Marcuse is saying, whoa, time out here, fellas. Right? Look at the fact that the body has become an object of your own enslavement, that your psyche is an object of your own enslavement. And that the ways in which the political events of today are being shaped is not by the radicals, it's by the establishment, as he loves to say, the establishment. So then he says, now let's look at this establishment for a moment and understand its dynamics. This establishment, as he says, has ushered in a new phase of capitalism. It's a new phase of capitalism. It's a phase of capitalism in which the ruling class, or bourgeoisie, does not have a culture of its own. So the relationship between bourgeois culture, the old bourgeois culture, and the ruling class of today has been severed. Classical music has as little to do with the Nixon administration as it has to do with, you know, people in the rainforest, right? In fact, people in the rainforest might have a better relationship to it. And furthermore, he argues, you radicals there, it has as little to do with anti-music, with rock and roll, with the sounds of the neo-modern music with its lack of tonality as it does with anything else. So that even among you who think the Jefferson Airplane is a radical form of music, I want to say something here. I have something to say. And he quotes Gracie Slick in his speech, quotes Gracie Slick, saying, you know, our whole point in life is we want to be louder. He says, so? What is this saying to you? You know, he talks about the living theater, who at this time are imprisoned. And he says, I'm writing this in critical solidarity. I stand in total solidarity with Julian Beck. But I want to say that the anti-form of the living theater is not a sublimation of the revolutionary moment. In fact, it's not creating an image of beauty that will help us transform the society. It might give vent to your feelings of frustration, but it is not creating a transcendence of those feelings. So in that form, it is a form of desublimation, of a creation of a frustration that moves against the moment of liberation, which for Marcuse resides in the preservance of the classical form of beauty, whether it's in music, in poetry, and he says at many points, how can you call these fragments of prose poetry? They're not poetry. There's a way in which the form of art and its beauty is something that is revolutionary in a society that degrades culture for the commodity form. For in a society based upon selling culture for profit, classical forms of beauty have a revolutionary transcendental value. When I first came across these ideas, I was like, Herbert, what are you saying? A symphony or BSO is a revolutionary site? I mean, come on, get real. So I don't claim to fully be able, to understand this. I'm trying to present Marcuse's ideas at this point because they're ideas that are very complicated. They're not simple ideas. His language has often been criticized as elitist. In fact, Marcuse focused on language as a problem of the revolution. He says at many points, first of all, the critique. When you say fuck Nixon, what are you saying about fuck? Fucking is a beautiful thing. Why are you degrading fucking by linking it to a war criminal? Or when you say shit on the pigs, this is Marcuse, his polymorphous perversity, anal eroticism should not be linked to the police, whose masochistic behavior, we all know the police love to, whatever the police love to do. And I think if Marcuse were here, he would furthermore say, and what's wrong with, why are you doing this to the pigs, to the animals, right? You're schimpfen, insulting the animals, right? You're insulting the animals. So, this is one moment in which he said to the movement, your language is a problem. Language. Go into your language. Look at what your language is doing to the future you're trying to imagine. Just as he said, look at your music. And look at how rock music, the loudness of the rock music, the fact that the individual doesn't exist, the mass is there. And the mass is there with a technology that is standardized and is affecting everyone in this way. What happened to the idea of freely associated individuals? What So, in all of these, this is the main argument of the book, I think, that Marcuse is making, that there is a level at which the counter-revolution exists in our bodies and in our psyches. It's not simply organized politically. It's organized at the psychological and art and level of art and level of our need. One last point on language that I think needs to be said. You're probably familiar with this, but Marcuse would say, yes, if you want to say my language is elitist, it is a problem. But the problem is not to reduce the language. The problem is one of education. Everyone should have available to them an education that would make the language that I'm using easily accessible. And the fact that the system is miseducating people, cutting funds for education, that television, the media are creating people who don't have the capacity to think. This is a real problem. Again, going back to the level of the body, the psyche, the fact that we need to work on ourselves as people. So, I think beyond those key insights, then, Marcuse is, this book is very much oriented to the movement. You will find Irwin Silber quoted from The Guardian and ruthlessly raked over the coals for saying that a working class family getting a washing machine is much more important than any other concern that the movement might have. Marcuse would say, this is just, what is this? This is proletarian culture? Proletarian culture, Marcuse is saying, no, this is adapting us to the system of consumer society. This is reducing the revolution to consumerism. So you radicals who are criticizing me for being elitist and who are saying I'm not part of the proletarian culture, I beg your pardon. But I think art's transcendence is what the proletarian culture needs to be about. And if it's not about that, it doesn't mean we go to washing machines, it means we build a culture. And the basis to build that culture is, in fact, in these classical forms. Now, maybe it's not going to be having the working class read Stendhal or whomever it is, but it's certainly not going to be in reducing it to consumerism. So let's talk about this. In this, you will find Marcuse talking about People's Park, the Black Panther Party, the Yippies, the Hippies. He talks about the Chicago Convention. He talks about events that, to those of us in the movement, were central. He talks about the Marxist-Leninist parties, PL, the SWP. You know, it's all in there. So if you're a radical activist at this time, this book by a philosopher is actually one of the few places where all of this is talked about in an integrated scheme. He's providing the movement with an incredible way to look into its past and its future. For those of you who don't know Marcuse, I should mention, you know, he was accused of being a CIA agent by PL. And he did work for the OSS during World War II, the Office of Strategic Services, the forerunner of the CIA. He spoke German. He was from Germany. He analyzed Nazi propaganda for the U.S. government during World War II in order to defeat the Germans. But I mean, if you go into his past, he stood with a rifle in Alexanderplatz in 1919 as a private. And during the Council Communist Movement in Germany, he was there. He went off to study philosophy, but he remained committed to the idea of some kind of liberation, of democracy, of liberation. His teacher, the same teacher as John Paul Sartre, was Martin Heidegger, who collaborated with the Nazis during World War II, and Marcuse was sent to bring Heidegger in after the war. It was a very difficult moment for him. I mean, he respected his teacher, but he did bring him in. And I think Herbert didn't want to use that word, but I don't think he actually handcuffed him, but I think he brought him in to the authorities after the war to be questioned. I think Heidegger was released. I don't think he was held, but I think he was questioned. I put on notice. Marcuse was someone for whom theory and practice were not separable. He wasn't just a philosopher, is the point I'm trying to make here. During World War II, he had been actively involved, I think, and continued to be actively involved. So in all of these considerations of the movement, what's his main point? His main point to me is Marxism is still the relevant body of theory for revolutions. But the varieties of Marxism passing around in the circles today are not really Marxism. They are ritualizations of Marxism. They are falsifications of Marxism. They are petrifications of Marxism. These are all words Marcuse uses to describe specifically again, I'll use his phrases, so I'm not misquoting him, the fetishization of labor. The fetishization of labor. After all, he says, labor is a commodity. We do fetishize commodity. So that the movement fetishizes the working class shouldn't be an... He talks about, quote, canned vocals, which kills their truth. And the specific words he's talking about here, that the left bombards people, he's back to the problem of language, with terms like imperialism, proletarian, exploitation, impoverishment, and it's, again, a quoting, without translating these terms into their actual situation. He's not saying don't use the term. He's saying you've got to find a way to speak to people. Now, he didn't say this. I'll say this. Huey Newton was the genius at this, the leader of the Black Panther Party. Huey Newton came, he would have every member of the Black Panther Party on Saturday walking around saying the three most dangerous people to the black community are the avaricious businessman, the crooked politician, and the, what was the policeman's adjective, and the avaricious businessman, the crooked politician, and the brutal policeman. What did Huey read to get to that? He read C. Wright Mills, The Power Elite, the idea that there's an economic, political, and military elite. And he translated that into the language of the black community, and his language was better than I can remember right now, because every Panther you met on Saturday morning would be telling you this. And you'd go, what happened here? And they'd go, oh, we had a study group. Chairman Huey's word came now. But the point is, that's the kind of thing that Marcuse is talking about having the movement do, is put it in the language, the vernacular of the people. Now, I don't know that we've been able to do that with any of these terms, imperialism. You know, for instance, if we say imperialist, try it on your way back from the talk. You know, go to some random person, I want to ask a question about imperialism. And they're going to, you know, you'll see there's a gap there. So you'd have to say it, you know, I don't know how you would say it. And Bono has good ways of talking about the problem. I don't know about the solution, right? But this is how those of us, or Angelina Jolie, is able to articulate the problem of this gap by having a child in Africa. It's a preconscious critique of imperialism, right? Which I think, anyway. So Marcuse is totally critical of the Leninist Party calling for a decentralized form of organization, not only because the seizure of power is no longer how revolutions will be made, the centralized seizures of power, but the building up of freely associated individuals who have new needs, and I'll come back to this question of new needs in a moment, that, you know, the idea of base and superstructure is obsolete. As Marcuse said to me, I've never seen this in his writing, it might be there, but he says, well, where would you put psychology? Psychology you'd have to put in the base. I thought, what? So, I mean, the concepts are obsolete. Super Marcuse. He talks about building up counter institutions, the long march through the institutions, Rudy Dutschke's idea. He's there quoting Daniel Cohn-Bendit. He's totally here with the movement. So he then, of course, in his chapters on nature and art, has very long discussions, which I think we'll have to come back to, because I don't want to use all the time. I want to go back to what Marcuse says about the new needs articulated that would be the basis of a revolution in the United States. As he says at the very end of the book, in the next centuries, for the next revolution will be the concern of generations, and the, quote, final crisis of capitalism may take all but a century. So he's talking in a long-term vision here of what are the basis in a society in which liberation is possible. That is not a fascist society, not a society that has collapsed, not a society that's underwater from the greenhouse effect and the 30-foot high rise in the ocean level. The society in which the basic system delivers the goods. People have enough to eat. Here's what he says. The revolution involves a radical transformation of the needs and aspirations themselves, cultural as well as material, of consciousness and sensibility, of the work process as well as leisure. This transformation appears in the fight against the fragmentation of work, the necessity and productivity of stupid performances and stupid merchandise, against the acquisitive bourgeois individual, against servitude in the guise of technology, deprivation in the guise of the good life, against pollution as the way of life. Moral and aesthetic needs become basic vital needs and drive toward new relationships between the sexes, between the generations, between men and women and nature. Freedom is understood as rooted in the fulfillment of these needs, which are sensuous, ethical, and rational in one. In other words, freedom is not about a washing machine. It's not about getting enough to eat, which he's not denying the importance of that for the wretched of the earth. He's saying in the strongest links of imperialism, which must be broken if the world is to be free. We've seen the weak links broken historically in Russia, in China, in Vietnam, in Cuba. It doesn't work. If the imperial chain of domination is to be broken, as Marx envisioned, it has to occur from within the wealthiest centers of power for the world to be free. And in that revolution, the needs are non-material. They're about ethics, morality, rationality, sensuality. This, I think, is extraordinarily... I mean, again, we can summarize and abbreviate this. It's about the quality of life. It's not about the quantity of consumer goods. But here's, Marcuse again. This change, the revolution, is in an ideological form, is foreshadowed by the counter images and counter values with which the new left contradicts the image of the capitalist universe. The exhibition of a non-competitive behavior, the rejection of brutal virility, the debunking of the capitalist productivity of work, the affirmation of the sensibility, sensuality of the body. I'll repeat that one. The affirmation of the sensibility, sensuality of the body, the ecological protest, the contempt for false heroism in outer space and colonial wars, the women's liberation movement, the rejection of the anti-erotic Puritan cult of plastic beauty and cleanliness. These are the tendencies that he's saying are part of the new left's existence, which are very positive tendencies. And which, if you remember at the time, there was within the movement, a great reaction against sexuality, right? Women's liberation was saying that free love made women into sexual objects. And a new Puritanism set in the movement, so Marcuse collided with this within the movement, I think, in this period of time.
That's an example of this.
There you go.
That even in their automobiles, they carry, it's like a passion. It's a passion to let everyone within any vicinity know that they drive a certain kind of car, that they can disturb the sleep of hundreds of people in the immediate vicinity,
right,
and let their friends across the river in Boston know that they've come home from vacation. And it's this type of insanity, this complete insanity, which needs somehow to be integrated publicly, so that there's a movement against these types of ostentatious manly exhibitions. Another example is these choppers or these motorcycles without any type of mufflers. They have this in South Florida. You can hear these things. You can hear these things for 10 minutes. They go by you, and you can, if you concentrate, you can hear them for 10 minutes. They slowly move into, and they're like, they're 10 miles away by then. This is insanity. This is true insanity. But it's accepted by the police because it's absolute virility. It's an expression of absolute virility. They sit on these things. They drive 10 next to it on vacation. They all weigh 275 pounds, but they're on these motorcycles. This is
well said.
But it was only 7.
Well, but it was, you know, that moment was there. I mean, that was in our experience, and we probably would have overlooked it, you know, if you hadn't said, look, here it is, right here, in the room, right now. So it's right. I mean, we're trying to have a discussion about something, and we're, you know, can't even hear ourselves think.
An excellent example of translating the concept of conversation to real life.
So, how are we doing on time?
We have 15 minutes for the discussion, or if you want to proceed more.
Let me try to wrap this up very briefly with one comment on Marcuse's, I said earlier that Marcuse was very critical of the movement's attempts to have anti-art substitute for art. And I want to try to explain that a little better because it is a very important notion. What Marcuse is saying, as I said, the White House and classical music have no relation, but he's saying the commodity system is destroying classical notions of beauty and culture. He says precisely, for instance, in the decline of the humanities in our education, which I alluded to in the problem of language, in the co-optation of liberatory subcultures for commodity form, for profit, that rock and roll has been made, it's gone from being something performed in the parks to being something that, you know, is a huge business. In the destruction of language, peace equals war. Nixon ran as a peace candidate in 72. More Americans died under Nixon's presidency than had died under Kennedy and Johnson combined in Vietnam. The decline of the father figure in the family and the replacement of the father figure in the family with big corporations and big institutions. The need for consumerism, in Marcuse's view, contradicts a work ethic. So that even, he's not arguing for a strong work ethic, but he's saying that we have forgotten how to labor. And furthermore, he says, in the reversal of innerworldly asceticism, the bourgeois culture's basic root is being torn up by the capitalist system's assault. The question he's asking is the movement's assault on bourgeois culture part of the capitalist system's assault on bourgeois culture? He's saying, think very carefully about this. You might think you're moving toward liberation, but you have to put it in a context where you are looking to destroy the same things that the capitalist system is already destroying. Is that really what you want to do? So I think, you know, this is a good place to end it. I thank Irv again, and thank you for coming, and look forward to our discussion here.